You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We've got a jam-packed Christmas bumper show for you today, where Kathy Hayward, the owner of Kemptown Books and author in her own right, is going to talk us through her five fiction and non-fiction recommendations. She's also going to talk about the process of rewriting one of her books for publication and about what the first couple of years have been like running Kemptown Bookshops. We also have a very special treat for you as Sussex-based writer Fran Swain reads her Christmas short story from her collection, The Dog Walkers. Enjoy the show. I am really happy to have Kathy Hayward, who is the owner of Brighton's beloved Kemptown Books, with me on the Brighton Book Club to talk about all things from Christmas book recommendations to rewriting her novel and to Brighton's creative writing programme. Kathy, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi, Anna. Thanks so much for asking me to be here.
So how are things at Kemptown Books? What has the last year been like for you?
Well, the year is always a bit of a... Kemptown Bookshop generally is just a wonderful but also slightly bonkers place to be. We are now kind of gearing up for Christmas. So now we are in November, although we don't have Christmas decorations up yet, because that would be really awful. We are definitely stocking up for Christmas and thinking about our kind of top book choices for Christmas. And I mean, basically in retail, and certainly in the book retail world, we make all our money from October to December, which keeps us kind of going until Easter, really. So this is a really crucial time of year for us, but a busy and exciting one as well.
Absolutely. So the Kemptown Bookshop has kind of really embraced the community and the community spirit and events. Can you talk a bit about the highlights that you've had in the last year?
So I think for me personally, the 5am club is always a personal highlight, because I love once a month getting up and getting to the shop for 4:30, and to get the coffee machine warmed up and set out the chairs and tables, and then welcome local writers to come along and write with me as the sun comes up. And although it's obviously much easier doing it in the summer months, I really love it when we're arriving in the dark and really we sit there together and write. And by the time we've kind of finishing at sort of 7:30, 8 o'clock, the sun is beginning to come up, and for me those are the most magical times of the month. But other things we do, we run the creative writing program partly out of Kemptown Bookshop, so it's wonderful to see a group of writers there learning and sharing together. So that's a bit of a highlight. But also some of the author Q&As that we do in the shop are always wonderful. And we've also got a partnership with Queen Spark Books, who are a local publisher of history books about the city. And they run a monthly event with us where they share some of their out-of-print books and read from them. And that's just wonderful, because you get a completely different view of the city and a different audience coming into the shop, and often an older audience who remember some of the things that are being talked about, which is always really fun. So yeah, always so much happening in the shop. And then of course there's the day-to-day people coming in, many of our locals who will pop in every day for a chat, chat about books, chat about life, and lots of other things. So it's a very special place to be.
So we're going to move on to talk about your writing later in the show, but I'd really like to know, because a lot of people I've spoken to who work kind of in an adjacent route to publishing that isn't necessarily full-time writing, often it can kind of stunt their creativity. Has working in and owning a bookshop helped or hindered your own writing?
Oh gosh, that's a tricky question, isn't it? I think in some ways it's hugely motivating being around books, and I'm very lucky that I spend most of my working life involved in books in some way. But sometimes there are such brilliant books that come out that it can be slightly depressing, because you think, oh wow, I am never going to get to that level. But it is also very inspiring, and I just love that. I still love, even though I've owned the shop now for 2.5 years, I still love that feeling of going in and looking at the main table and seeing what's come in since the last time I was there. And so that's always hugely inspiring. And also getting the chance to chat to some fellow local authors as well is always interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, we've had many guests on the show over the last year who have, made note of how supportive you've been. So clearly, supporting local writers is really important to you at the Kempton Bookshop?
Yes, definitely. Certainly when my debut novel came out in 2021, it was really hard to get it stocked in some places. And City Books were really, really supportive. And I'll never forget how wonderful that was to be able to go into City Books and have a stack of my books to sign and take pics and stuff. And they were really welcoming. So I really want to make Kemptown Bookshop that place that we really support local authors and want to kind of champion their work. And in fact, we've just had new display bookcases created just for local authors so we can better display their work. So yeah, it's really important that a local indie bookshop champions local authors because that's kind of what it's all about.
Oh, I absolutely agree. So I have asked you, Kathy, to pull together a list of 10 fiction and 10 non-fiction books, not necessarily new, but ones that you think are really worth people having on their Christmas lists or perhaps buying for their loved ones this Christmas, obviously from the Kemptown Bookshop. So where would you like to start?
Well, let's start with non-fiction. And I have to say, I found it really hard to stick to five of each. And if you could see me here, I am literally surrounded by a pile of books that I was trying to shortlist down to five non-fiction, five fiction. But in terms of non-fiction, I'm going to start with Wintering by Catherine May, which is... I first read a couple of, somebody bought it for me when I was going through a really difficult time. And it is that perfect book. When someone comes into the shop and they say, oh, I've got a friend who's going through X, Y, Z, I'm not sure what to get them. I always recommend Wintering. Catherine May gives readers permission to kind of retreat from life and kind of repair ourselves and offers wisdom on how to use these kind of fallow periods of life. So we're really ready to embrace the spring. And although obviously we are coming into winter, you can read this book at obviously any time. I've recommended this book hundreds of times and bought it for numerous friends myself. And it's the one book that people are guaranteed to kind of rave about. I feel like we live in a really kind of supercharged, fast forward world. And this book really offers the reasons to kind of just stop and think and reflect on life. And Catherine spoke at the Brighton Festival earlier this year. And I got the chance to meet her and she is just a wonderful human being. So yeah, that's definitely my first recommendation is Wintering by Catherine May. It came out in paperback this year as well, which is always handy. Second one is Scattered Minds by Gabor Maté. I love Gabor Maté's work. I'm not really a science reader or a medical reader at all, but his work is always so interesting. And Scattered Minds explores the myth of attention deficit disorder as being genetically based, as in inherited. And he kind of really offers hope and advice for children and adults who live with the condition. One of my children... was diagnosed with ADD a few years ago. And the book is fantastic, basically about showing that ADD is not an inherited illness, but it is reversible and treatable. And not just with medication, which is typically what is recommended. So I found the book really, really interesting. I recommend it to anyone who is thinks they have ADHD or has a young person with ADHD. So yeah, brilliant book. So highly recommend that. And back to a local author, Caroline Lucas, who wrote Another England. Obviously, Caroline was at one time the Green Party's only MP based here in Brighton Pavilion. And she has written a brilliant book, which is really looking at how the right of the political spectrum have hijacked Englishness. And the only people who can dare speak about Englishness are the cheerleaders for Brexit and imperial nostalgia and things like that. And her book is looking at some of the other stories, which are equally compelling as Brexit and imperial nostalgia, talking about English people's radical inclusivity and their commitment to the natural world and the long struggle to win rights. And she kind of delves into our literary heritage to explore what it means to be English, and how we can use it to deal with some of the most pressing issues of our time, particularly around the toxic legacy of empire and constitutional reform and the climate emergencies. And she's kind of sketches out this alternative Englishness, which has a kind of a greener, fairer future. And it's such a life affirming book, and really, again, I heard her speak at the Brighton Festival, and she's just such an inspirational person. So highly recommend Another England. It's still in hardback, I think, at the moment, but we do have a few signed copies in Kemp Town Bookshop if anyone wants one. So the last two, non-fiction, is another local author actually called Emma Jane Unsworth, who's written a beautiful book called After the Storm. And it's about that period of the utter madness of new motherhood. And it's a really beautiful account of postnatal depression. She talks about how her life was like nothing like it used to be. And she became both obviously exhausted, but also furious. Much of it is set in Brighton. So she's there with her buggy, pushing it onto the pier and just looking out at the sunset. So it's lots of familiar places. And also for any mothers, it's kind of familiar. There's lots of like hilarious accounts of things, some grim things like botched stitches and bleeding nipples and anger and shame. And it's a really raw book, but really brave look at postnatal mental health. I came across it a couple of years ago when I was researching for a book that I'm writing. And it's a real celebration of survival as well. So, definitely something to read, perhaps not to give necessarily to new mothers, but maybe a little bit later on. I think, yeah, wonderful book. And then finally, actually a book I picked up in the Oxfam bookshop in Brighton. And it's really, it's called The Folklore of Sussex by an author called Jacqueline Simpson. And it's a really interesting account of all the different kind of bonkers folklore of our county. I grew up in Clapham, which is a little village outside of Worthing. And there's loads of folklore about Clapham Woods with tales of occults with dogs being sacrificed and later UFOs. And when I was there in the 80s and early 90s, it really kind of kept us villagers on the edge of our seats. This book actually debunks those particular stories, but it does have really fascinating accounts of Cissbury and Chanctonbury Ring, and also looks at things like folk medicine, which many in Brighton obviously still use today. So really, really interesting book. And particularly if you're looking to ever set any kind of stories locally, that could be a really interesting research read. So those are my top five non-fiction recommendations for people looking for Christmas.
Thank you so much. So much to think about there. I'm scribbling down the names of all of these, and I will make sure to not only include them in the show notes, but also pop them on our Instagram page at BTM Book Club. Thank you so much, Kathy. Let's move on to fiction.
Okay, so my number one fiction read is Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver, which was my favourite read actually of last year, but I've been talking about it all this year too, so I thought I'd include it in my Christmas reads. It's a beautiful retelling of Dickens' David Copperfield, set in the Appalachian Mountains in the US. And it follows Demon as he kind of navigates the perils of foster care and child labour and derelict schools and addiction and loss. But there are brief moments of love and success, so it's not an all doom and gloom book. You don't have to have read Dickens to read this story, but it's really, I found it really interesting to watch how Kingsolver kind of cleverly matches her plot lines to David Copperfield. I think what's really depressing is how little has changed since Dickens was writing about child and institutional poverty almost two centuries ago, because it's still there and it's obviously in the Appalachian Mountains, but also obviously in our own city. So it's a beautiful read. And anyone who knows David Copperfield knows there is a happy ending. So you do know that you're going to get there in the end, but it's tough reading at times, but really, really good. Then a book which came out in July is The Unwilding by Marina Kemp. I love stories about family secrets, and this is one just full to the brim with family secrets, intrigue, memorable characters. It's set between Sicily and Blackheath in London, and I absolutely adored it. The descriptions of the food alone, when they're sitting out underneath the lemon trees in Sicily, it's just salivating. So I was sent a proof copy of it, and I didn't get around to reading it until August. And I had been talking about it ever since. So yeah, The Unwilding by Marina Kemp. If you get a chance to grab a copy, then I definitely recommend that. Then a bit more of a classic, Until August by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. This was posthumously published against actually his wishes. He apparently said about the book before he died, "This book doesn't work, it must be destroyed." And I think he wrote it from about 2003 until his death in 2014. And by then, of course, he had been living with dementia for about 10 years. But his sons feel that actually his dementia meant that he couldn't really understand how good the book was. So they decided to go against his wishes and publish the book. And it's really rather wonderful. It's very short, and it's about the erotic adventures of a middle-aged mother who every August leaves her unnamed country on the Atlantic coast for 24 hours on a Caribbean island where her mother chose to be buried. And there she has a yearly affair with somebody, a different person each time. And it's a really interesting interesting read, and classically, just beautifully written. So definitely recommend that. And then to finish, two more local authors. So Windmill Hill by Lucy Atkins. Came out in hardback last year, but is just out in paperback. And it's a story inspired by the Jack and Jill windmills in Clayton. Lucy grew up in Sussex, but now she lives in Oxford, and I think actually teaches creative writing at Oxford University. But you can tell from the beautiful descriptions right from the start that this is Sussex. So anyone who loves the Downs, the Sussex countryside, this is definitely one to read. And it's about two protagonists who are feisty octogenarians, and I do really love a kind of slightly different character. And they're really so well written that Astrid, who is the lead character, she's often in pain, and the pain is written so well. You can really, really feel it. The structure itself is really interesting. It's all about, again, about family secrets, but it kind of starts with Astrid being at the airport, and she is inching forward in the security queue. And we all have experience of that at Gatwick Airport. And as she's doing that, she's reflecting on her life. And she's on the way to Scotland to stop her ex-husband from publishing a tell-all memoir, which reveals some really deeply held secrets. So it was described as Me Too for octogenarians. And it's a real celebration of women, friendship, eccentrics, freedom, bohemians, and I guess being a bit unconventional. So it feels very Brighton. So I would definitely recommend Windmill Hill by Lucy Atkins. Joanna Glenn, who is one of our lovely local authors, had a great new book out called Maybe, Perhaps, Possibly this year. But my favourite of hers, which I still recommend to everyone who has a mother or is a mother, is a book called All My Mothers. And it's just a wonderful look at motherhood in its many forms. The character is searching for her own mother, and along the way, she meets women who really challenge her very idea of what a mother should be. Again, it's partly set in Spain, which is so well drawn. You can smell the oranges that she's writing about. So I would definitely recommend All My Mothers by Joanna Glenn. I think it's been out a few years now, but really it gets better every time I read it. And then finally, I really can't resist this, Rivals by Gilly Cooper. So I don't know whether anyone has been watching the Disney Plus series. Oh my God, I watched it twice already. I grew up with Gilly Cooper books. I was at boarding school and we had copies of Riders and Rivals, and we sniggered under the bed covers about them and hid them from the nuns. So I have to go back. I haven't yet reread it, but I will be rereading it this Christmas, just because it's so wonderfully 80s and kitsch. And we have sold so many copies already in Kemp Town Bookshop, because there's obviously lots of people who are feeling rather nostalgic for Gilly Cooper in their lives. So yeah, do try either for the first time or reread Rivals by Gilly Cooper. And those are my five fiction reads.
Thank you so much. I must say, I have just finished watching Rivals and I'm in love with Danny Dyer.
Yes, so good. So good.
Thank you so much, Kathy. There's some really, really fantastic books in there. I am personally very excited to get my hands on a couple of them. So I would love to know what books you're really excited about for next year. And actually, while we're here, talk a bit about the process of how books are sold into the shop, because you have a small footprint, right? And you cannot stock everything. So how do you decide?
So it's a really interesting one. There's five of us who work in the shop, and we all buy books. So it's not one person's vision, because obviously that would be wrong, because that's just one person's idea. So we all take it in turns to look through the bookseller, which is obviously the weekly magazine which comes out, which talks about all the new books. But also, social media is a great way of finding out, but particularly about lesser well-known books, perhaps from smaller imprints. So the real indie presses, we can get their books in through just finding out about them on social media. So that's really important. We get approached directly by publishers, particularly the smaller publishers, to say what they've got coming up. And of course, if it's a local author's book, or has a link to the city, I should say as well. So we will make sure that we stock their books. So it's a real balancing act. And sometimes the books that you think are going to do really well just don't. And ones which are kind of really unexpected sell really well. So it's always a balancing act. But yeah, it's a fun job, and you kind of go wrong really, because you bring in, we always sort of test the market out with just one copy of a book, and see how it goes. So yeah, it's a fun process.
And what books are you really looking forward to stocking in 2025?
Oh gosh, there are just so many. I'm particularly interested in books about magic and sort of a bit of fantasy. So we've got A Witch's Guide to Magic, which is coming out in 25. So I'm looking forward to that. Great Big Beautiful Life by Emily Henry, I think will be a good one for us. Oh gosh, who else? Trying to think other ones that are coming out. Swept Away, Beth O'Leary, is coming out next year, which will be good. Adrienne Young, A Sea of Unspoken Things, will be out.
So, if you are a sharp-eared listener of the Brighton Book Club, you may have heard Kathy a couple of years ago on the show talking about The Girl in the Maze, her novel. Now, The Girl in the Midnight Maze has just been published, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Kathy about how not just one word changed in this book. Kathy, let's go back to the beginning. Let's talk about The Girl in the Maze and how that then has been re-released.
Okay, yeah, so one of those slightly strange, weird, and wonderful twists and turns in book publishing. But I was lucky enough to get a publishing deal in 2020, and in 2021, The Girl in the Maze came out. It was through Agora, who are a small imprint of the agents PFD. They then in 2022 decided to change things and not actually to continue publishing books. So they closed down Agora, and therefore the rights then of The Girl in the Maze reverted back to me. But by then I had an agent, and the agent sold those rights along with two other books to Lake Union, who are part of Amazon Publishing. And they liked The Girl in the Maze, but they didn't feel it was right for a global audience. The first version of the book started with a woman sitting in a bathtub in the 1930s, who is pregnant and unmarried and is contemplating having an abortion. And they didn't feel that was right for an American audience, which I could understand. And so they asked me to rewrite it. So I found myself in a slightly odd position of 3 years after I had a book published, going back and rewriting it. And it was a kind of a strange thing, because I'd kind of slightly forgotten about these characters, because I'd since then written two other books. But actually, it was rather wonderful to revisit and to kind of create a whole new storyline for a couple of the characters, beef up some characters kind of got the chop, and it was really interesting. And I think it is a much better book as a result, because when we edited it with Agora, it was a very small team there. When I went through the Lake Union editing process, and I know that some other Brighton Authors, also published by Lake Union, and it's a really rigorous editing process they go through, and it's become such a better book as a result. So I'm really proud that they decided they wanted to have a different name, but I think they actually really probably thought that The Girl in the Maze was a good name, because they just renamed it The Girl in the Midnight Maze. So not an enormous difference, but yes, so that came out on the 1st of November.
It's really nice to hear a story about a book kind of getting a second life, because I think that, stories we often hear in the industry is, once your book's out in the world and, if it doesn't do really well, for instance, then it's kind of dead in the water. It must be so nice to be able to see it kind of reach new audiences.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and particularly a global audience, because with Agora, it was very much a UK book, whereas Lake Union have got it all over. It's in Australia and in America and here. So it's got a completely different audience, really. And it's really exciting to see it out in the world. And I have on my bookshelf, like the original copy and then the new one. So it's, as you say, it's like a second life for it, which is rather wonderful.
Absolutely. I'd love to hear an extract, Kathy.
Okay, so anyone who ever read the first version, we don't start in such a precarious place. We ease the reader in a little bit more gradually. So chapter one, Emma, January 2019. Emma's phone rang as she was peeling potatoes for mash. She glanced at the screen, but she didn't recognise the number, so ignored it, cutting the peeled potato in half before adding it to the pan. Her son James wandered into the kitchen, headphones clamped to his ears. He grabbed a carton of milk from the fridge and lifted it to his lips. "James, use a glass," she said, nodding towards the cupboard. He rolled his eyes but poured the milk into a glass and sat down at the kitchen table. "How long till dinner?" 30 minutes, she said. "How was college?" James shrugged and looked at his phone. "Same, same." "Best bit of the day?" coaxed Emma. She remembered asking the same question when she used to pick him and his sister Libby up from primary school. "Best bit of the day? Worst bit of the day? What did you have for lunch?" She learned that after receiving a standard response of fine. They would compete on who could describe the most outlandish things that had happened. Now they were both teenagers. She was lucky if they answered at all. James didn't look up. "I scored a couple of baskets in practice and coach asked me to join the first team." "James, that's amazing." Emma smiled and rested her hand on his shoulder. A faint blush crept up his neck. "You must tell Dad when he gets in." James nodded and focused back on his phone. "How many sausages do you want?" Emma asked, slipping them out of the packet onto the grill tray. "Six?" he asked, hopefully. Emma laughed and got a second packet out of the fridge. "Do you want any help with revision later? I could go through those index cards with you, ask you some random questions." "Okay," he said. Really, she should try to finish off the survey for the new development. She'd only got halfway through before she'd had to leave to pick up Libby and take her to street dance. That was always the challenge, trying to fit what was a full-time job into part-time hours. But Emma loved her afternoons off. Since James started school all those years ago, she'd only worked from 9 to 3, meaning she could pick him and Libby up every day and spend the afternoon with them. Even now, they both tended to do their own thing, James at basketball or out with friends, Libby hanging around in town. She still liked being at home when they arrived, and they knew she was there if they wanted her. She could finish the survey after she'd helped out with the revision. Libby came in and sat at the table. "I saw you with that girl at lunch," she said to James. James narrowed his eyes and mouthed "fuck off." "I saw that," said Emma. "It still counts as swearing, even if you don't say it." James rolled his eyes again slightly and looked back at his sister, mouthing something Emma couldn't interpret. Her phone rang again and she glanced the number. It was the same one as earlier and she still didn't recognise it. She was about to answer when Nick came through the door. "Hi, gang," he said. "Nice to see everyone here rather than hiding in your rooms." "The draw of dinner rather than my company, I think," laughed Emma as he pulled her into a hug. "How was your day?" "So-so," he screwed up his face. "Client meeting was a complete fiasco. I spent most of the day trying to sort out the mess." "Oh, I'm sorry. Why don't you change? The dinner will be ready." "Fab, I'm starving. Libby James, could you lay the table, please, while I serve up?" There was a general grunt of disapproval, but they both slowly got up and reached for plates and cutlery as Emma started putting pans of steaming mash, peas and beans on the table. Nick joined them and Emma dished up, making sure to put plenty on Libby's plate. She'd been looking far too thin recently. They were halfway through dinner when Emma's phone rang again. She put her fork down. "I know we say no phones at the table, but I just want to check it's not that number again. Someone keeps calling me." "One rule for us," said Libby. "Libby," said Nick. "Enough." It was the same number. Emma clicked accept and said hello as she walked out of the kitchen door, closing the door behind her. "Hello, is that Emma Bowen?" There was something official about the man's tone of voice that made her heart beat slightly faster. "Speaking? My name is Mr. Eels. I'm calling out Margaret Chapman, your mother, I believe." "Yes?" Had she had a change of heart? "I'm sorry to inform you that Margaret died earlier today." It was very peaceful. The voice was soft. Emma felt her throat constrict. She held the phone against her chest, unable to speak. Almost immediately, tears spilled down her face. Mum was dead. She'd always thought they might reconcile. She'd rushed to her mother's bedside several times over the past 20 years of her illness, as she had gone in and out of remission. She'd become so used to her recovering that she thought they'd always have time to make things up. She swallowed with difficulty and raised the phone to her ear. "Hello," she said. "Hello, Mrs. Bowen." The voice was quiet, understanding, someone who was used to delivering bad news. "I realise this will be something of a shock for you. May I suggest we talk tomorrow morning, once you've had time to digest the news? We can then talk about the arrangements. Is there a good time for us to speak?" "Any time," Emma managed. "Thank you, Mr. Eels." Emma ended the call. She opened the kitchen door again and looked at Nick and the children around the kitchen table. They were laughing. Three faces turned towards her. "All okay?" said Nick. "It's Mum," said Emma. Her voice broke. "She died earlier today." "Oh, Em." Nick was on his feet, holding her as her knees started to give way. He guided her back to the table. What a shock. Both James and Libby stopped eating. Libby got up and put her arms round her mother from behind. "Sorry, Mum. We love you." "Thanks, Libs," said Emma, wiping her eyes. "I'm sorry too, Mum," said James, frowning at her. "I think I'm going to go upstairs for a while," said Emma, getting to her feet. "Leave you to finish off here." "I'll come with you," said Nick. "No, I just need a moment on my own," said Emma. He gave her another hug. Lying on her bed, she let the tears come. But what was she crying for? She and Mum had never got on. She felt guilty that she hadn't been there at the end, though, especially when she dashed up to be with her mother the other times. Had she died alone? No, Mr. Eels had said it was peaceful, so there must have been someone with her. As her only child, it should have been me, Emma thought, crying harder. But their relationship had always been strained. Even as a young child, there was a feeling of slight relief that it was at an end, and it made Emma even more guilty. Later, when Nick came up, she sobbed into his chest. "I don't know why I'm crying so much. I didn't cry like this when Dad died, and we were always so close." Nick stroked the back of her head. "I think it's because you're mourning the relationship you never had." And that was it, exactly, Emma thought.
Thank you so much, Kathy, for reading that. It's so different from The Girl in the Maze.
It is. I mean, it's the same, more or less the same sort of story, but yeah, presented quite differently, and with some of them were slightly different characters. So if you did read The Girl in the Maze originally, then it is a different book. It'll be a new read.
You must have had to kill a lot of your darlings when you were rewriting this book. How did you find that?
Oh, it's a horrible bit, isn't it? But I think I just had to trust the publisher that this is what would work, and they know the market better than me. So yeah, I just had to trust them. And my agent was absolutely amazing, actually, with some of them, because I think when they first sent the first editorial letter back, it was kind of like a bonfire of characters. And I was like, oh God, I really like some of these characters. But I do think it's a better book as a result.
So, Kathy, not only do you own and run a bookshop and write novels yourself, but you also run the Creative Writing Programme in Brighton. How do you even manage all of these things, firstly?
It's a lot of juggling and a lot of coffee. But I'm lucky that things are quite seasonal, and I have the lovely Remini Hart, who now is the bookshop manager. So she does a lot of the day-to-day, and I do the bit of kind of, I work there one day a week and have a lot of fun, but she does all the management of it. I'm a busy person, that's for sure. But I think that makes you more productive, probably.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the Creative Writing Programme now. For anyone that's listening who hasn't heard of it, can you give us an overview?
So the Creative Writing Programme was set up in about 20, about 2000, year 2000, in the University of Sussex as part of their adult education programme. So it was to support adults who wanted to learn to write creatively. And it's a 2-year course. And then in about 2012, the university decided to no longer run the programme. I think tuition fees were in and they decided they didn't want to do adult education. And so Dr. Mark Slater, who had set it up, decided to bring it out of the university and run it separately. And he did that until about 2023. And when we started working on it together, and then I've taken over this year. But it's a 2-year programme which really takes you from zero to hero. So you can have no experience of creative writing, but perhaps a desire to write a novel or a collection of short stories, or if you want to do life writing, a memoir. And it will take you through all the different stages over those 2 years. So by the end of the 2 years, you could have a first draft of a book. And that's what happened to me. So I did the course in 2015. And by the end of 2017, I had about a half of a first draft of what became The Girl in the Maze, and now The Girl in the Midnight Maze. And it was just a brilliant, really brilliant tutors. We run it in person and online. And it's a very supportive atmosphere. And 2 years is a good time to really learn that craft of writing. I'm not sure I could have written a book without the course, and certainly not on a shorter course, because I just wouldn't have had that kind of discipline. But over the 2 years, I really got into that writing rhythm, and it gave me that discipline. And we have some amazing alumni as well who come out of the programme and publish really amazing books. So yeah, it's a real pleasure to be involved in the course that of course set me on track to be a writer.
Can you tell us a bit about some of the tutors?
So I think the longest standing tutor is Hannah Vincent, who's been involved, I think, with the programme for about 14 years. She has written, I think her most recent book is a collection of short stories called Alarm Girl. We have Bethan Roberts, who is obviously well known in Brighton for writing My Policeman, which went on to be a film, which starring Rupert Everett and Harry Styles. She's also written, I can't remember the name, Graceland, which is about Elvis Presley's mother. We have Katie Massey, who teaches the Life Writing Programme, who writes both fiction and memoir. We've got so many people. We've got Mick Jackson, who was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. We've got a lady called Elaine Chu, who's a relatively new tutor for us. Lots of different people. Rosie Chard, who is the author of 4 books, and was in fact my tutor when I did the course, and she still teaches on it. So we've got some really brilliant brilliant tutors. We also run poetry, slightly shorter poetry courses, which are run by Dr. John McCulloch and by Roy McFarlane, and we run an advanced writers programme for people who've done the 2-year course but still want to have a bit of a discipline of writing. But yes, all local people working with local writers, which is rather fab.
And what does the structure of the course look like?
So we start with approaches to writing, which is the 2-year course is basically made up of 4 separate courses. So the first one is approaches to writing, and it's really about kind of getting you into that rhythm, that discipline of writing. Because if you haven't written before, obviously it's to do that feels like quite a big step. So it's approaches to writing is the first one. And then you kind of go into tactics for writing, so really kind of digging down a little bit further, so onto like characterization and to placemaking, and to really we look at it as that kind of helical structure where you start with small details and then you get down and down and down into the really nitty-gritty, and then the third course is story structure, where you're looking at how to structure the overall piece, but also perhaps individual scenes, even paragraphs, chapters. And then in the final one, we have writing workshops where we look at people's more long-term work and share and give critical feedback on that. So it doesn't sound that much, but over 2 years, it really takes a lot of people from, as I say, having very little experience of creative writing into often having the first draft of a novel. We've had some amazing students who've actually published work while they've been on the course, which I just think is extraordinary. I certainly wasn't one of those people, but some of the alumni are fantastic.
I'd love to know, Kathy, what the biggest mistakes people seem to bring to their writing that you've noticed when running the course, and maybe what the biggest mistakes you made in your, early on in your career.
I think what I have learned is that it's not always the most talented writer who will get their work published or indeed finish their novel. It's the most tenacious writer. So my biggest mistake is I kind of think if I don't look at my novel for a while, it'll somehow write itself. But of course it doesn't. And it's really about getting through that really uncomfortable bit of sitting your bum on your seat and looking at the blank page and rewriting the same sentence over and over again. It feels a little bit like, to me, like a yoga class or like running, when the first bit is really, really awful and awful, and you're thinking, why am I here? This is just terrible. And then you get past that wall, and then you think, oh, it's still a bit terrible, but actually it's bearable now and I can do it. And then when you look back on it, you look back on your writing, you think, well, some of it's crap, but actually there's some bit here which are quite nice. And the same with running, you look back and you think, okay, some of that run wasn't so bad. So I think that is the thing. It's about the biggest mistake is thinking that it's a long time. It takes a long time to write a novel or a collection of stories, and it's not something that you can do quickly, or that very unfortunately does itself for itself while you're not looking at it. It takes time to nurture it and write it, and that can be frustrating.
Absolutely. And what would you say are the most kind of valuable pieces of advice that you've picked up along the way?
I think this, I've certainly, since I started writing, I have come up with my own writing routine, which really works for me. For me, that's a really early morning start, hence doing the 5 a.m. club in the bookshop. But that doesn't work, obviously, for everyone. Some of us are night owls. Some of us have, very young children or other caring responsibilities. So I think that the most important piece of advice is to find out when is best for you to write, both for your creativity but also for your life as well, and really carve out that time. And even if it's a half an hour or an hour a day, really dedicate that time to it and try to put your writing first. So I think that is the most important piece of advice. I think the other one is just to keep going. Part of the book that I'm working on at the moment is written in the first person, and I hadn't written in the first person before, and I was talking about it on the writing community on Twitter, and they kept saying, look, just keep going, don't write, as in don't try to write a scene, just write what that character is thinking and feeling, and then it will come. And it took a long time. I was trying to do it like 7 days, just writing nonsense, and then it eventually came, the character's voice came. So I think, yeah, those are probably the two biggest pieces of advice for me. Find the best time for you, and just to keep going even through the really difficult bits.
And is there anything about the publishing industry as a whole that you've really been privy to as a bookseller that you would never have had access to as an author?
I think I've learned a lot more about self-publishing. So we obviously get approached, as I know other bookshops do, from authors who want to self-publish books. And mainly that's because they haven't had any luck going down the traditional publishing route. And for us, it's really hard to accept self-published books because we have an automated system that if we sell a copy of a book, we will then reorder it back in. If we can't get a book from a main supplier and we have to go back to the author every time, that makes it life very difficult for us because we have 6,000 books in the shop, and if we were to do that with every book, we'd very quickly go out of business. And so it's really opened my eyes to how difficult it is to get books published, because for me personally it happened quite quickly. I was incredibly lucky. So I speak to a lot of authors who have gone down the self-publishing route, and some have had their work professionally edited and had professional covers, and their work looks fantastic. And sometimes we do stock those types of books, particularly if it's local interest, so perhaps it's set in Brighton or it's about Brighton, it's a non-fiction book, and in that case we will. But often I think people get lured into self-publishing and think they are going to get their work in local bookshops, and that's actually incredibly difficult, difficult to do. So yes, it's definitely opened my eyes up to how difficult and perhaps exclusive the book publishing industry is, and how lucky we are that we have small presses who will take risks on different types of work, so we can have more inclusivity in the sector.
Absolutely, I completely agree. Kathy, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, it's wonderful. Thank you so much, Anna. Lovely to chat to you.
For the first time ever on the Brighton Book Club, we are bringing you a very special Christmas story. And this year it is going to be from Fran Swain. So Fran is a Brighton-based writer with a passion for the short form. She has had stories shortlisted in several competitions and a story published in the Brighton and Beyond anthology. The Lost Dog is a story from her linked short story collection about the unexpected connections between dog walkers. She is currently working on a novel about the slum clearance in Brighton in the 1930s. You can find her over on Instagram at fran.e.swain with an E. Over to you, Fran.
Thanks, Anna. The Lost Dog. The house was quiet, except for the knocking of the radiator pipes and the sound of Jack's breathing. He stretched out into the empty space next to him in bed, and for a moment he felt almost peaceful, at ease with himself. Within just a few short minutes, the stagnant heaviness that had become so familiar to him in recent months began to form in his stomach. It was going to be another bad day. The only difference about today was that it was Christmas Eve, and by late afternoon, Caroline's family would have descended upon them. They'd come, laden with presents, merriment sweating from their pores, and laughter would be heard in every room of the house. Reluctantly, he pulled himself out of bed and went downstairs. It was past 12 already, and outside the window, slate-grey clouds bubbled in the sky. He wandered barefoot into the lounge. In the corner of the room stood the Christmas tree that Caroline had painstakingly spent hours decorating a few weeks before. They'd had the same Christmas tree for years, a small and slightly wonky-looking thing that every year would be dragged out of the attic and covered in the mismatched array of decorations they'd collected over the years. They even had the original lights they'd bought with the tree, probably so old they were a fire hazard, but the lights had pink bulbs, which were virtually impossible to find these days. This Christmas, he hadn't bothered to turn the fairy lights on in the evenings. Every day when Caroline got home from work, she'd walk into the lounge, sigh and say, "Why are you sat with just the big light on?" She'd go around, flipping on all the switches, including the lights on the tree. The main light would be dimmed, and Caroline would look around the room and say, "That's better," as if the lighting would fix everything. In the kitchen, he made himself a coffee and noticed a post-it note on the table. "Happy Christmas Eve! Everyone is getting here for 6, and I shall be back from work by 4. Maybe you could try going for a run today." It had been over a week since he'd left the house. Maybe a change of scenery would help to quell the dread creeping into his throat. Caroline's family were warm and welcoming, but this year, the idea of a house full of people for 2 whole days made his stomach feel like he'd swallowed concrete. Digging out some jogging bottoms and an old hoodie, he laced up his trainers. As he opened the front door, he caught a glimpse of himself in the mirror. His dark curly hair was overgrown and bushy, and he was desperately overdue a haircut. However, the idea of going to the barber's and answering questions about where he was going on holiday or how his job was going was just too much to bear. The last time he'd left the house had been when Caroline asked him to go to the post office, and without thinking, he'd gone in the middle of the day. As the queue had slowly inched forward, he felt a tap on the shoulder. "Hey, buddy, I thought it was you." The voice belonged to Samir. Jack forced his face into a smile and shook the outstretched hand as he was pulled into an embrace. "How's it going?" Samir said. "We've missed you at running club. Life's just kind of got in the way, you know." "I know that one, what with my 3 kids." Samir laughed, and Jack attempted to match the size and pitch of it. "You got the day off or something?" "Just working from home today and thought I'd pop out and post this parcel as a bit of a breather." Jack waved the parcel in the air as proof. Samir placed a hand on Jack's shoulder. Good to see you, mate. Hopefully catch you back at the club soon. Jack waved goodbye. The lie he had told Samir pushed down on his chest, like an overly affectionate cat, refusing to budge. Nobody knew why Jack was signed off work, except Caroline, and his boss, who had been surprisingly good about it all. The shame he had felt at handing over the sick note was second only to visiting the GP to get it in the first place. The doctor had been sympathetic, but 10 minutes later he was packed off with a prescription, still unclaimed, on his bedside table, and a letter to his boss saying 6 weeks would sort him out. All the same, he'd asked his boss to say he'd put his back out, the same line he'd used with his friends when they invited him to the pub. A few half-hearted stretches later, he stuck in his earbuds and pulled the front door closed. He headed off the road and onto the public footpath, starting to pick up speed as the Sussex countryside blurred around him. Beneath his feet, his running shoes were only covered with a slight smattering of mud. Despite the threatening clouds, it had been dry for weeks. Above, a bird sang at the top of its lungs. He didn't know much about birds, but he was amazed at the power and tenacity that this one lone bird seemed to have. He looked up at the view, the South Downs rolling on forever. He usually ran with Caroline, in silence, where the only sounds were their jagged breathing and feet thudding in time on the ground, the hills stretching out in front of them. Usually in winter, they'd crunch through the frosty fields together, cracking the ice in the once muddy puddles and watch their breath swim through the air. But for the last few months, Caroline had run alone, and the silences between them no longer felt comfortable and safe, but more like a knife could slice open the tension. The initial sensation of drive didn't last long. He slowed to a walking pace, panting and red in the face. Frustrated he'd let himself get so unfit. He slowed to a stop and bent over, trying to catch his breath. Oh dear, overdone it, have you? Through his legs, he could make out two white-haired women walking towards him. He stood up, took out one of his headphones and tried to smile. You're one to talk, Susan. You couldn't run if your life depended on it. I hardly see you running any marathons. The two women continued to chatter as they walked ahead of him. Only joking with you, sweetheart. Happy Christmas. He mumbled a goodbye, unable to utter the greeting back. This year, he just wished he could skip Christmas entirely. He carried on stretching, the laughter of the women ringing in his ears. These days, seemingly small or inane comments had such an impact on his mood, like a punch in the gut. The rain clouds still threatened, and he longed for a heavy downpour. Those clouds had been making empty promises for weeks. Jack walked towards the woods. As he reached the bridge, he stopped and looked down at the train tracks. He leaned over the parapet and thought back over the last few months. He'd constantly felt numb, like everything was pointless, like he had no place in the world. When the feeling had first started, the only way he could describe it was like someone had died. He even called around his whole family to check no one had. Everyone was fine, and while he was glad of that, the feeling of grief continued. On paper, his life was a dream. Nice wife, nice house, secure job. Yet no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't seem to shake this feeling of despair. Leaning over the bridge, the damp bricks seeped cold into his hands as he stretched over to look down at the railway tracks. It would be easy enough to hop over to the other side, scramble down the bank, and wait for the next fast train to London. He'd be doing everyone a favour. As he took his hands off the bridge and stepped back, something shoved him hard, throwing him onto the ground. Jack looked up. There in front of him was a large, blundering dog, now intent on licking his face and slobbering all over him. Get off, he yelled as he tried to untangle himself from the wire of his headphones and push the dog off him. The dog backed off, sat and tilted its head. Jack hauled himself back onto his feet and dusted himself down. Great, he muttered, looking down at his jogging bottoms that were now caked in mud. Just typical. He brushed off as much of the mud as possible and wiped his hands on a nearby patch of grass. Putting in his headphones, he started to walk off, but the dog followed him. This is really not what I need today. He shooed the dog away, but it wagged its tail and looked up at him expectantly. Where's your owner? He said, looking down at the dog, but this only caused the dog to get excited all over again, jumping up and shoving its muzzle into his face. Okay, Jack said, pushing the dog off. He looked up and down the path that ran alongside the woods, but it was empty. It was just him and the dog. After a few minutes, Jack pulled out his phone. He supposed he'd better try and give the owner a call. He bent down to read the number off the dog's collar, but there wasn't one. The dog's neck was bare. On closer inspection, it was a beautiful dog, its coat a burnt, rusty orange, and a girl. Jack had no idea if she had run away from her owner or escaped from a garden, but he could hardly leave her on her own. The dog started to wander off, nose to the ground, as she followed a scent down the footpath. Jack picked up a stick and encouraged her to hop the stile with him into the field next to the bridge. At least from there, he'd be able to see the path that ran alongside the railway line if the owner appeared, and would hopefully have a better chance of keeping the dog from wandering off. He threw the stick as far as he could and she tore off after it, her ears flapping on either side of her head. Just as quickly, she was back at Jack's feet, dropping the stick on the ground and eagerly waiting for him to throw it again. They repeated this action over and over, each time the dog darting off to fetch the stick, her back legs bouncing like a hare. To Jack's surprise, he enjoyed the repetition of the game. Or rather, he enjoyed the look of joy on the dog's face as she bounded off after the stick for the umpteenth time. Rain started spitting, and Jack zipped up his hoodie. The clouds were moving quicker now and darkening by the minute. As he walked slightly further into the field to give the dog a longer throw, a man with a small, scruffy terrier emerged from the woods. The terrier ran up to the dog, and Jack watched as they took it in turns to sniff each other. The dog then lowered her front paws to the floor and wagged her tail. The terrier barked and the two dogs tore off down the field. "All right, fella," the man nodded as he reached Jack. "These two will be tired tonight." The dogs darted in and out of the two men, incorporating them into their game. Jack laughed as the dog popped its head out between his legs and then ran off in the opposite direction, encouraging the terrier to follow. "Nice looking dog you've got there," the man said. "I'm a big fan of Hungarian Vishlas. Such noble-looking dogs, and she's certainly a stunner." Jack was about to deny ownership, but something stopped him. Instead, he just smiled, feeling a strange sense of pride for a dog that wasn't his. The dogs had stopped their chase and now stood slightly apart, panting. "Come on then, Millie, my girl," the man said, calling the terrier. "Let's head home." The little dog appeared at his side. "Happy Christmas, fella." Jack raised his hand in goodbye as the man and the terrier disappeared across the field. The clouds had started to turn a steel grey, swollen and ready to burst. From the other side of the field, Jack heard a woman shouting. "Coco," the woman called out repeatedly. He looked in the direction of the voice and saw a small woman in a furry hooded parka. The dog's ears pricked up and she tore off towards the woman. When the dog reached her, she secured the collar around the dog's neck, clipped on the lead, and jogged over to Jack. "You found my dog, thank you. I've been running around looking everywhere for her." Jack went to reply, but the woman ploughed on. She saw something she wanted to chase, slipped her collar and was off. "I honestly thought I'd never get her back, and on Christmas Eve too." She took a breath and looked at the dog. "You're so naughty, Coco. Don't think Father Christmas will be bringing you anything tomorrow." They both looked down at Coco, who showed no signs of distress and instead looked mightily pleased with herself for her little adventure. "It was no problem," Jack said, bending down to fuss Coco. "She's a lovely dog." The woman laughed. "Yes, but quite the handful. She's three. You'd never think it, though, the way she still acts like a puppy." Jack listened as she continued to chatter about her dog, telling him about the time Coco had slipped her collar and stole food at a wake. The woman was a good storyteller, and Jack laughed as he pictured Coco causing so much trouble. "Moral of the story is, I need to get her a more secure collar," the woman said. Together, they walked back towards the bridge. When they reached the stile, the woman indicated she was going left. Jack bent down to fuss Coco, her big brown eyes locked onto his, and she wagged her tail. He cupped her face with both hands. The attention caused her to jump up, almost headbutting him. He gave her one final pat on the rump. "Happy Christmas," the woman said as she turned and walked down the path, Coco trotting along by her side. "Happy Christmas," Jack called after her, and he realised he meant it. At the bridge, Jack stopped and looked down the tracks towards the tunnel further down the line. The spitting rain had now turned into drizzle and the daylight had started to fade. On the path that ran alongside the railway line was a little boy and an older man. They were pointing towards the tunnel. A train was coming. As it hurtled noisily past them, the little boy waved at the train. Jack held his breath as the train passed beneath his feet. He walked the few paces across the footbridge to the other side and watched as the train disappeared into the distance. He swallowed and quickly turned back to see the boy was still waving. Jack waved back. Back home, the darkness began to creep back into his stomach. It was only a few hours until everyone started to arrive. After he had showered, he reached for his comfort sweatshirt and jeans, but stopped. Instead, he opened the wardrobe, studied the hangers filled with clothes, and pulled out a fresh pair of jeans and the jumper Caroline had bought him a few months ago that he'd not yet worn. He went downstairs and into the living room. The rain had got heavier, and it drummed loudly on the water butt outside the window. It was only 3 o'clock, but the room was gloomy. In less than an hour, Caroline would be home. Jack walked over towards the Christmas tree, bent down to the socket, and switched on the lights.
Thank you so much, Fran, for the reading of our first ever Christmas story, and Merry Christmas.
Thanks, Anna. Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much for listening. Make sure you're following us on Instagram at BTN Book Club and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get yours, where we will include all the information for everything we spoke about in today's show.